There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the bill we got? I mean, the bill we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, you're banned.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5 at Midday Mobile, hour number two on a Thursday. Glad you're here. Phone contact information, because I've not blocked it. I might block you, but I don't think I'm going to block you. 343-0106, 343-0106. That, if you're just joining us, that goes back to the conversation from last hour, our conversation with Secretary of the State of Alabama, John Merrill, and this suit, lawsuit over him blocking people on Twitter. You can go back and listen to the podcast from last hour and check in with that interview. Happened in the second segment of last hour. I mentioned the story this morning, and I was thinking as I was doing this story this morning and kind of expanding on it, I said, I really need to get my buddy Ben Raines from AL.com on the line with us to talk more about it. And like that, magically, ladies and gentlemen, Ben Raines. Hey, Ben.
Sean, you know, you call, I'm there.
It's good. That's good. I like that response. No, I was talking this morning.
And I will not block you or anyone else.
Well, just wait. The hour's young. You may block me by the end of it. But no, I was talking about Red Tide this morning because Kelly had a headline. She was talking about Florida Governor Rick Scott was chased away from a campaign event by demonstrators criticizing him for the toxic algae bloom, the Red Tide that's been affecting Florida. Now, I understand where people could be really twisted up about the Red Tide, just anybody. But in the state of Florida, where so much business depends on tourism, people going to a beach, this is a huge deal. It affects a lot of people. But I said that was, in my opinion, misplaced demonstrators hollering to act like the one person in that position has a, like an on and off switch for a Red Tide. I said that is, in my opinion, I'll hear where you come at this, overly simplistic view of the issue of Red Tide.
Oh, yeah, this is a problem decades in the making over there. I mean, literally decades, if not a century in the making. And the, all their chickens have really come home to roost. When you look at the population alone, you know, and they've got to deal with that much sewage and everything. And, you know, they did this test in the Keys, and they were able to, you know, they were having all these problems with the reefs. And it was a similar situation where nutrients were causing problems. And they were able to actually track the people's poop in the ocean. They were finding their DNA in the ocean from their septic tanks and things. And that just sort of, you know, gets at the kind of massive problems they have. Then you add on to that Big Sugar and all the sugar plantations and then the Everglades. You know, this is not the governor's. You're right. There's no magic wand to wave to fix, you know, several million septic tanks, tens of thousands of acres of sugar plantations, and then the Everglades and all the nutrients going in there.
Yeah,
it's a real mess. And we're going to, you know, we've suffered from Florida Red Tide before. That happened in 2015. We had a huge outbreak here. I experienced it firsthand. I was out scuba diving in clear water, and I came up, and there was a huge layer of red tide over me, and I had to swim right up through it to get to the boat. And it was dramatic. You know, the water, when it happens, it looks like blood. It's really, and, really something to see.
And let's talk about that. So it looks like blood. We call it the red tide. Let's go Dr. Science on this thing here for a second before we get more into the discussion. What is red tide?
So it is a little organism, a dinoflagellate called Karenia brevis, K. brevis for short. It's sort of halfway between an animal and a plant, and it can grow explosively, like going from very few individual little organisms to literally millions overnight.
And what? Go ahead.
You know, there are a lot of harmless versions of this that are close relatives of it, and we'll see blooms here of them. We had one back about 2008 or 9 that made the water in the bay, and particularly Fish River and Magnolia River, the color of Coca-Cola. But it had no, it didn't have the toxins associated with red tide that hurt, you know, fish, kill fish and things, and cause breathing problems. It just caused oxygen problems here.
Now those are neurotoxins I was reading. I mean, that's what the red tide gives off?
Yeah. So it gives off these toxins that hurt your eyes. They hurt to breathe, and ultimately they can overwhelm, you know, your entire system. Now, we don't hear about that with people because, you're a person, you get in your car and you drive away. But, you know, imagine you're a fish, particularly a small fish, doesn't migrate or travel very far, or you're, you know, a sessile organism that can't move, like an oyster or a clam or something. You're just stuck there. And this stuff will, you know, clog all your breathing apparatus and ultimately result in your death.
Okay, so the this algae that's there, you said, is there in some amount all the time, but is it the fertilizer, the whatever, you know, the myriad of things that become food? Is it become food for the algae? Is that why they reproduce themselves, or what happens?
Yes, in a nutshell, yes. All the nutrients we put in the water, and when we say nutrients, that sounds positive. But we're talking about fertilizer components, you know, nitrogen, phosphorus, these kind of things, and they're good for your plants in your yard. Well, by the same token, they can make things grow in the water. It's just sort of a catalyst. It's fuel. And then you couple that with sunlight. You know, we have these red tide issues in the summertime, not in the wintertime typically. And there's a reason for that. These things play together. And a lot of times, this is also when we have the most rain, so we've got more runoff. So more of the fuel items, the nutrients and stuff, are getting pushed into the water while we have this massive sun. You know, we're on the same latitude as Cairo, so we have this intense sunlight beating down on the water. The water's about 90 degrees right now. These are just perfect. Everything you'd want if you were going to be a little red tide organism to grow is happening right now. And so it sort of stays on the Florida coast all the time in measurable numbers. And so then when they have these super ripe conditions, it can explode. What happens with us is we get some from Florida will either spread along the coast here, or a whirl of it will get picked up in the current and show up here. So we don't have the toxic issues they have, or the toxic, I'm sorry, wrong word. We don't have the constant issues they have in South Florida. As I mentioned, last time we had a big episode was 2015, and I don't remember an episode before that was particularly noteworthy, really, in the decade before for Alabama.
All right, come back. I want to talk more about this because it is, as talking about spreading down the coast, it has shown up now in Bay County there, Panama City area. And, is it something that spreads here, or is it something that could develop here? And what could be done to abate this going forward? We'll continue our conversation with Ben Raines from AL.com right here on Midday Mobile.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, 120 FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile on this Thursday. My buddy Ben Raines talking red tide with us. And this, you say, well, that's a world away. That's something they're dealing with down in, you know, the Fort Myers. That's no issue for us. Heck, it's shown up in Bay County, Panama City Beach. That's not too far down the highway, Ben.
That's not too far at all. And what probably happened is a chunk of it spun off in a current whirl and worked its way up and washed into the bay there in Panama City, if I had to guess, which is, you know, exactly what I was saying could happen here, that I think has happened here in the past. So it just sort of shows up, and you've already got a full-blown incident going. They're talking about the population there being medium concentrations. Well, medium concentrations are plenty to cause, you know, distress for people walking on the beach and stuff like that. Everywhere else between here and there are low or non-detect. So, you know, right now we've got a little buffer, but if it gets to Pensacola, we'll be seeing it.
Right. Well, okay. So, but if we're talking about the fact that this algal bloom here, they're present at some level in the water everywhere, but you give them that flush of nutrients that comes off of, and we could talk about all the different ways, but they get that flush, they reproduce at a high rate, they then, you know, obviously you have the issue with the red tide and this bloom out there. Can the same thing be true in inverse? In other words, if they, let's say that that pocket of red tide washed up on a coastline that didn't have tributaries coming out, didn't have a high nutrient load, it was wherever. Okay, I know you're going to argue with me, everybody has it, but we're going for my science experiment to a stretch of coastline that has no nutrient load other than what's in the natural system. Does that red tide starve out and go away?
I think that place fares better. I think it doesn't persist. It doesn't sort of self-populate once it gets going. Yeah, I think if you know, Tampa St. Pete, you're talking about one of the biggest population centers on the Gulf Coast, and certainly in Florida, and that's where the chronic problem has been.
I mean, because
you know, it speaks right to your point. That's exactly what's going on.
Okay, so I'm probably going to use the wrong term, but it's food, right? It's food for it, something to keep them alive, keep them reproducing. If you take away their easy access to the nutrients or their food, they eventually go back to normal levels.
Right. And you know, they basically will burn a spot out, too, and consume everything, and then you'll see them retreat. But what really will set them back is winter. You know, get that sunlight out of the mix. That'll help a lot. I mean, obviously we're not getting sunlight out of the mix, but we're getting a less intense sun as we move into wintertime.
You know, I think about this in its effect. You know, just think about Florida and those sections of coastline. If you're somebody rents a boogie board or beach chair or something like that, and this shows up on your stretch of beach, I mean, you're out of business.
Yeah, yeah, and that's what's happening to the people in you know, South Central Florida. They're being shut down by this as a tourist spot. You know, you can't invite people to your beach if it makes them sick.
Right, and so, but this, you know, I worry about that for our beach business, too. Not that it's here, but if something washed up on our beach for some period of time, we could see an impact like that that would shut down people wanting to go to our beach.
Well, and we wrote stories about that with that 2015 outbreak. You know, there were people coming to the beach who didn't want to go out on the beach because it made them feel bad and all that. And, you know, we're talking about itchy eyes, runny nose kind of feeling, bronchial irritation, that kind of stuff. And that's just, you know, walking on the beach. And I didn't really experience a lot of those symptoms when I came up through at that time because I had my mask on, was breathing through my regulator. And once I got up onto the boat, you know, they were ready to go because they had seen it come. So we got out of there as quick as we could.
And with the scenarios here with this red tide, you talk about burns itself out. I've seen the pictures, kills these fish. Most of the fish I've seen, you probably look at the same pictures and you and I ask the same questions, seem more looking like a lot of menhaden, maybe pinfish, some eels and things like that. Does it affect, is it just because those are going to be right there next to the shoreline or in those areas, or does it affect, is there any research one species more than another? Is there?
Well, so your menhaden, your filter feeders definitely get whacked worse. Because that's how they feed, is
right.
Capturing organisms like that with their gill rakers. And, you know, mullet,
right.
All the filter feeders, sardines, everything at the base of the food chain, cigar minnows, all that stuff. But, you know, there have been a lot of big animals, like turtles. And you know, of course, they breathe air. And so a turtle gets surrounded by this stuff, and they get overcome. They've had a lot of big sea turtles die. And I think there have been a number of manatees that died. Now, again, these are not really fast-swimming creatures, and these are creatures that have to come up to the surface. And, you know, your menhaden and stuff exist at the surface. You could imagine a big cobia could go down 80 feet and swim beneath it and never even know it was there.
Right.
You know, and so that, I think, has a lot to do with the fish you're seeing. And it is that near-shore thing. You know, the bloom is out 80 miles off the coast in some places. And the big bad part in Florida is about 150 miles of coastline. It's a significant area.
Is this similar to, you know, people around here have, we've talked for a long time, the dead zones out off the mouth of the Mississippi River form each year. Is that red tide or is that something else?
No. That's other algae. And what the dead zone is algae that blooms when there's a lot of nutrients and a lot of sunlight. So it blooms in the summertime and then it dies and falls to the bottom. And decaying matter of any kind sucks up oxygen. And so that's what happens. That you just have to imagine like this constant snowfall of algae that's falling as it dies to the seafloor and decaying and consumes all the oxygen. And of course, we have that in Mobile Bay. We have it every summer, and there's a lot of evidence that it's an expanding problem in Mobile Bay. The state has been monitoring these dead zones in Wolf Bay and Mobile Bay, all these little nooks and crannies, every summer, and they set up like clockwork. And then, of course, that is what causes our jubilees. That's the key component of the jubilees. The salt water, the fresh water sits on top, and the salt water can't get any oxygen into it. Then you have these algae blooms that suck up even more of the remaining oxygen, and that water that gets pushed towards shore, these big plugs of low oxygen salt water are what cause our jubilees.
The hypoxia, but wouldn't that happen even without the? I think it happens because, like you said, bigger nutrient load. But in a natural environment here, without humans here at all, wouldn't it still happen the way? I mean, with wind set up and heating of bay temperature.
Well, there's a lot of debate about that, and some people will argue that there were jubilees 200 years ago. Of course, there were a lot of people and a lot of cows and pigs 200 years ago, and a lot of sewage going straight into the rivers with no filtration of any kind.
Right.
So, we don't really have a good understanding of whether it would happen without people at all. We do know this is one of the only places in the world it happens.
Right.
And we know that they're now becoming a regular occurrence on the western side of the bay, which historically had never happened.
That's true.
And now they're having, a half dozen, a dozen a summer, which was not the case 20 years ago.
So, Yeah, you're right. I mean, I'd never heard, growing up, I'd never heard of them on the west side. It was always people in Baldwin County that had them. So, is there any baseline to see if the nutrient levels have increased? Because, I think if you look back 20 years ago, I think there was probably less being done about water quality than we're trying to do now.
Right, and that's one of our challenges. Alabama has been really lucky. When you look at like the Chesapeake Bay, which is similar in size, they've had these problems for decades. The Chesapeake Bay crashed in the 80s with low oxygen issues and basically wiped it out for a time. And the difference is we've got 15 million people around Chesapeake Bay. We've got about 3 million people that drain into Mobile Bay. So we're kind of on the beginning of that spectrum. But the fact that jubilees are increasing and a couple of other telling events are big warning signs for us. If you look back, I think it was 2009, you remember we had this huge epidemic of lesions on fish coming out of the winter in the early spring.
Yep.
Every kind of fish. You remember redfish, speckled trout, flounder, mullet, sheephead, you name it, you'd catch one and it would have lesions all over it. And the state was investigating, they were telling everybody not to eat anything, and what ultimately was determined to be the cause was pesticides and fertilizers coming off of farmland due to a whole lot of rain after that cold winter, and it just stressed the fish out. So what that tells us is we're that close to tipping the bay into this terrible place where the fish are getting lesions from all the pesticides we're putting on the field. It was just we had more rain that winter, and that was enough to push us into this situation. So, we have issues we need to address for sure.
Well, how localized is it? You mentioned, Ben, 3 million people draining into the bay, but I would argue that if you consider the fact that we're the foot of the Alabama and the Tombigbee River drainage, right? It's got to be more than 3 million.
Well, yeah, and the 10 Tom really does change that equation. I was really talking just about Alabama's population, but you're right. Whatever's coming down the 10 Tom is definitely a significant contributor, and that's kind of draining part of America's breadbasket where they use a lot of fertilizers. This is one of the things we learned in the oil spill was we don't spend near enough money monitoring the Gulf of Mexico in general. And as a state, Alabama really needs to step up and do a lot of monitoring of its bay, Mobile Bay, so we have ammunition to argue in the future with other states, just like they do with the Mississippi. They can say, hey, all you farmers up in Minnesota and Point South are screwing up the Gulf of Mexico. Well, we need to start thinking that way, I think, here in terms of Mobile Bay. So we can say, hey, all you farmers, up north Alabama, you're part of the problem down here. You got to help be part of the solution. We really need to start monitoring that stuff. Doesn't help when we have the least funded environmental agency in the nation.
Well, it would seem to be that it would be, is it as simple as taking a nutrient load reading from let's say you and I will plot 15 points on the Alabama River, right? And see if that, how that nutrient load increases from the first plotted point to the last. Is it, you know, if it, and to see where the contribution's coming.
That'd be a great place to start. And there may be a lot of, there may be more data than we know. There's been an ongoing study called Focal, done by the Sea Lab of Mobile Bay, and it goes out about 40 miles out into the Gulf and measuring all these different environmental parameters, you know, salinity and all that kind of stuff. I wouldn't be surprised if they're monitoring some of these things we're talking about.
Hey, let's do this. I'm up against the hard break. Can you
outline a perfect... Do what you just said.
Okay, can you hold on 1 second? We're up against the bottom of the hour news break, but we're coming right back. More with Ben Raines and your text, too, coming in. We'll get these questions answered when we return.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
We're at 135, FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile on this Thursday. I'm glad you're along. Phone number, text line 343-0106. You want to share this discussion or any other of the 40-some-odd hours of live local programming we do a week with somebody, go to our podcast page. You can click the link there and embed it in an email or some other social media post and share it with folks. So if you want to say, listen, we were talking about Red Tide the other day, you can share this hour. So check it out, fmtalk1065.com. Look for the podcast drop-down. And then, even better, you can just subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher and get these podcasts delivered directly to you. And remember, streaming online at fmtalk1065.com and through the TuneIn Radio app. All right, continue our conversation with Ben Raines, AL.com, and a man that surfaced into Red Tide himself one time, and he lived to tell about it. I would
have barely, right?
Yes, but I mean that's interesting. You talk about up close and personal. I have not been that up close and personal with Red Tide, so you are higher up the firsthand experience ladder than I. So I want to run through a couple of questions here that are coming in. First of all, Jace says this, or asks this. He says, what is it that has caused the fish kills in Fowl River in the past? There was a fairly significant kill maybe a decade or so ago. You could smell all the way down to the island, meaning Dolphin Island. Said memory serves. They said back then it was an algal bloom caused by summer sun that took all the oxygen out of the water. What was that?
So that was probably a relative of... K. brevis, the one that causes red tide. You remember I mentioned the Coca-Cola one?
Mm-hmm.
And so these different, you know, we had a Jubilee-like event when we actually filmed for America's Amazon. And but it was different than a Jubilee because the water was discolored and the fish were just dying. So it was some sort of, harmful algal bloom that was killing the fish. So there are a variety of things. You know, when things get in thick enough concentration, bad things happen. They can suck all the oxygen out of the water, and people don't necessarily think that could actually, you know, kill fish. They just say, oh, it doesn't make sense, but it happens quick. If your entire system depends on sucking oxygen out of the water column and the level of oxygen goes down, it can quickly spiral into a major fish kill, you know, with thousands of fish. The other thing that causes a lot of fish kills in Fowl River and the rivers on the other side of the bay is cold. In the wintertime, the menhaden and stuff will pool up in deeper water back in little bayous and things, like, canals and things like that. And they get trapped there, and the water just gets colder and colder and colder, and they all just roll up dead. So fish have, they want to be where conditions are perfect. You know, they have historically, for millions of years, had a stable level of oxygen in the water. That they have evolved to survive with, and when it dips even a little below that level, they can have fatal consequences pretty quickly. Because, of course, the fish are consuming oxygen too, not just the algae.
Right, right. And what the nice thing is, I mean, that's a whole other show, but the way nature is, you have that big fish kill, and if you don't, if all other conditions are normal, how quickly they reproduce and replace themselves, at least in warm environments like this, most species.
Yeah.
They fill the space back up. You know, they're like, oh, okay, let's fill this back up. All right, speaking of Jubilees, Bill says, I remember Jubilees on the west side of the bay 30 years ago. Because I said I didn't. It was, I remember growing up, we were always jealous. You know, I'm a west sider. I was always jealous of my east side buddies that got to go to Jubilees.
Well, you know, and that's kind of an interesting comment, because if you look back 30 years ago, Mobile County was one of the top five counties in the nation for air and water pollution. You know, all those chemical plants were going great guns and dumping all kind of stuff in the water. And, you know, even in the 80s, the paper mill and all those plants didn't have any kind of sewage systems going for the most part. They were dumping, you know, human waste straight into the river from their employees and stuff. So, you know, maybe there was something going on 30 years ago. That predates me here. I've only been here 20 years. So I don't want to discount Bill out of hand, because maybe, you know, he did experience some Jubilees, but maybe there were other factors at play. Maybe there was, you know, poison issues or who knows what.
You mentioned sewage. This texture says, are you saying that septic tanks are the sewer problems, or that the sewer plants are the problems in the rivers in the Gulf?
Septic tanks are a much worse problem than treated sewage.
Y'all, this is where Ben and I, by the way, we would let people know, this is Ben and I go, when we're not on there, go round and round on this. But I
have a septic tank.
I know.
So I'm, you know,
you're a contributor.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I'm 120 feet above sea level and stuff, but still, you know, when you look at all the septic tanks on Fish River, Fowl River, Dog River, you know, those are septic tanks that are basically underwater most of the time, as far as the water table goes. And that stuff is just, you know, it's going straight into the system, kind of like mainlining. You know, if we ever did a DNA study like they did in the Keys, you would be able to pick out the DNA of everybody on Fish River in the water column.
Yeah, y'all are swimming in their DNA.
The septic system.
Yeah. Yeah, and when I say you and I butt heads on it, really, it's not that. I actually agree with you on issues with the septic tanks. I also just think that the sewage systems at large are big contributors. But, you know, I keep on my soapbox. My soapbox about... Huh?
And especially the poorly managed ones. And we have a lot of those in Alabama.
Well, I mean, you talk about putting nutrients, air quotes here, y'all, nutrients in the water. You know, I know that your argument with me over time has been, you know, dilution is a solution to pollution, that I obsess too much about the sewage overflows. But if we're looking at issues like this, if it is this nutrient load that causes these algal blooms at a level beyond what's normal, what's natural, then anything that contributes to the nutrient load is a big environmental issue.
You're right. I guess I would tell you that the spills from the big storms are usually so ephemeral, they happen and they're gone so quickly, and that energy gets consumed, you know, within 24 hours for the most part, and we might have a fish kill in the wake of one or something like that. But I think the bigger, more chronic inputs are what's coming down the river and off the farms and all that.
Well, yes, you have a chronic, you have, I guess, a main line and then spikes on top of that. Is that fair?
Right. Yeah, yeah, I think so.
All right, so what do we do about it? I mean, because somebody said, oh, here, let me get the text. They said, where does it stop if we blame North Alabama for the waterway and the waterway continues on through Tennessee, Kentucky? Is Mobile Bay going to blame all the states above? You know, I go back to the, you know, the Bass Pro Shops, you know, mantra.
Well, we
all live downstream, right? Huh?
We should clean our own house first. You know, I would say we should be pulling every septic tank on a waterway out of the ground with BP money and paying to hook those people up to a sewer line we build with BP money. That just seems like a no-brainer to me.
And speaking of which, Heather asked a specific question and said, my parents live on Fowl River, have a septic tank system, so you're saying that their septic tank system is below water level and their waste is going into the bay?
It's not necessarily below water level, because then it won't function at all. Usually they'll be elevated a little bit, but what I'm saying is the water table is so high, there's no perking going on really to disperse or dilute what's coming out of the septic field lines. They're pretty much making their way straight into the river, because everything, you know, if you live along the river, everything that happens on your property and underground on your property goes to the river. That's the low spot.
What about, you mentioned fertilizers, okay? And we have local ag, you know, but as a state, the amount of ag now versus 40 years ago is a lot less. There's a lot of row crop ground that's now growing pine trees, you know? I mean, now, there's a lot of row crop ground that's now hard surfaces and leads to bigger runoff. I completely see that and agree. But in just, you know, the amount of people, you know, tilling ground and putting fertilizer down, I think that's got to be less.
Yeah, but then to what you just said, the amount of people, there are a lot more people. So there are a lot more people generating waste and fertilizing their lawns and you know, using their septic systems and all that. So I'd imagine we're probably at least about where we were when we had a lot of row crop going on, you know.
Is there a happy medium? You know how I like to do this. Is there a way to, just like when you talked about, hey, let's just leave the lock and dam system open some on the Alabama, you know, with the benefit of migratory fish species when it's not being used, let's lock some fish through and let them go through. Same thing here. I mean, people want to have a good-looking lawn.
Well,
they want to fertilize.
Chesapeake Bay.
Huh?
They've rescued Chesapeake Bay. It now is thriving. You know, there are fish in Chesapeake Bay again. I wouldn't say thriving, but it's functioning.
Yeah, they're still buying their blue crabs from us down here, right?
yeah, they are. But part of what's happened up there is they did some pretty draconian things 20 years ago, like banning phosphates from detergent, from soap. You know, that was historically how they made soap get stuff clean, laundry soap, dish soap, whatever. But those chemicals were really potent in terms of growing algae in the bay. So that was kind of a national, you know, it led the nation. Those things are not banned here. Now, a lot of national products don't carry them, don't have them anymore because they don't want to have different formulas to sell Tide in Alabama versus, you know, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of smart things we could do that would probably go a long way. You know, Alabama doesn't do a good job managing our water resources in general. And you know, just look at how much groundwater is sucked out of Alabama to spray on sod farms. Guess what? Nobody knows because we don't measure it. We give out permits, but there's no limit on how much someone can draw, and there's no record of how much they're drawing.
Can we argue that look at the rain bands here. Look at the amount of precipitation. Are we not recharging the aquifers?
Well, that's a 50 to 60 year cycle to recharge the 100 foot aquifer. You know, it takes that long for the water to perk down that far. So we are recharging them, but not as fast as we're sucking them out. They've done some studies, and they can pull water out and tell how old the water is. And so we are now, instead of consuming 100-year-old water, in Baldwin County, there are a lot of these wells where my understanding is they're now getting very, very old water, which means the old water is pushing up out of the, you know, from deeper and getting used, as opposed to the water that, you know, perked down 50 years ago. Now, I think we can see that, and this is just my speculation, but I think you could see that if you go look at Magnolia Spring, for instance. You know, people talk about that river being crystal clear when they were kids, and they talk about that spring boiling. Well, if you go look at Magnolia Spring, it is barely pumping. It is barely functioning. There's a pond in Fairhope near the marina.
It's still cold as all get out, though. Wait a second. It's still cold as all get out in the springs. So, I mean, I don't know when I jump
it's
off.
Colder, yeah, but
makes me squeal.
Well, but that river is not clear like a spring-fed river. Magnolia River is not a clear river anymore. And I think it's because the springs are not pumping with the vigor they used to pump because, you know, all those sod farms in that part of the county are sucking up massive amounts of water. You drive through Magnolia Springs and down County Road 49, and then take 12 over toward Foley, there's nothing but sod fields. And every one of them has one of those huge, you know, Western-style sprinkler things out there spraying the grass all the time.
Well, the center pivot
yeah,
irrigation.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
And last one here, quickly, because we're running out of time, but Dan has asked a couple questions about this. He said, Bill Finch was just talking about how the loss of Mobile's oyster bays has been a big contributing factor to dead zones in the bay. May this be part of the problem?
Sure. And, you know, oysters are filter feeders, and they definitely help clean the water and clear the water. But, you know, what's killed a lot of the oysters was the dead zones. And that's the reason a lot of those old reefs can't be repopulated, because that's the, you know, the deeper reefs, like the Whitehorse Reef, which is kind of off Fowl River. It's about 16 feet where their old reef used to be, I think, maybe 12 feet, something like that. Anyway, Dead Zone sets up there every year. And so when the state moved a bunch of oysters from Brooklyn to there trying to restart that reef, they were all dead within 3 weeks from low oxygen.
There you go. All right, we're going to have to continue this conversation on a future show. I want you to quickly, though, let folks know if they want to take a tour with you. My mother was asking me the other day, she said, is Ben still doing the tours at the south end of the bay, too, or just in the Delta? Which ones?
I do both. I do them all on request. I actually, last weekend, I had three tours, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Sunday was 6 15-year-olds. And they were great. It was one of their birthdays. A bunch of 15-year-old boys, and so we mixed the tour up a little bit. We went and found a rope swing and stuff like that. But it was really fun to see young, you know, people engaged in the bay, and they were definitely, you know, into the nature and everything, and not just obviously they weren't drinking beer. But.
That's right.
But I'm about to start the Upper Delta tours. Usually in October, that's when I do that. That's when the orchids are blooming up there, and we go see the big cypress, and you know the snakes are gone and all. But those South Bay, you know, Mississippi Sound tours are really fun. We get out on the islands and walk around and, you know, people can swim and stuff like that.
If somebody wants to get on one of these tours or, you know, book one for their group, how do they get in touch with you?
Facebook is a great way, or my email, which is brains@al.com. But Facebook is really good messenger in there. And I'm easy to track down.
That's for sure. Send me an email and I'll put you all in touch. Ben, thank you, man. We'll talk soon. Ben Rains checking in here on Midday Mobile. We're coming right back. Grab some calls and text at 343-0106. Professional-collision.com.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 1065.
Right, 155, FM Talk 1065, Midday Mobile. Fine bombs on the way shortly. And so many good events going on tonight with our friends at Cottage Hill Package. Number one, you got the Mothership Cottage Hill Package, the store there at Cottage Hill at Hillcrest. But they also have got Havana Ray's Cigar Lounge. That's there in Midtown, there by right by the Loop. You got that to go to. But I would say tonight, if you're a craft beer fan, the Mothership is calling to you, because at Cottage Hill Package tonight, Sweetwater Brewing Company's Jeff Bacon's going to be there with a mini bar on the sales floor, sampling some new Sweetwater brews. Their 420 strain, G13 IPA, Mosaic single hop, their hazy IPA. Plus, they're going to have some swag, some logoed Sweetwater stuff for you. Dalton, that's perfect. It's your birthday. That's your favorite beer. You can go get some logoed stuff. Also, Emily from Boston Beer Company, as in Sam Adams, is going to be there with the Sam Adams Oktoberfest tasting and Stein hoisting competition in the back bar. They're bringing a bunch of Sam Adams beer for us to sample. And this Stein hoisting competition, it's how long you can hold a Stein of beer. Okay, so it's how, you know, one of those, like, they'll hold your finger on the Corvette and the last person gets to, this is going to be who can hold the Stein up the longest. Go see for yourself. Maybe you'll come home with some prizes tonight if you think you can hold that Stein longer than others. This all starts at 6, and it's at Cottage Hill Package, Cottage Hill and Hillcrest. And then also another free tasting with Ghost Train. They're going to be there on Friday night. You've got the Birmingham Beverage Company, this Ghost Train, with their Kaleidoscope Kettle Sour Ale, their Chugga Peach Cobbler Sour Ale, their Judge Juicy Hazy IPA, their Switchman Stash IPA. It's got to be a lot of fun to name all these beers. Check them out. Cottage Hill Package, corner of Cottage Hill and Hillcrest, online at cottagehillpackage.com. And check them out on Facebook as well. And remember, Havana Ray's Lounge, open now in Midtown. All right, before we run out of time, because this is talking about running out of time. If you've never seen Kiss before, you're about to run out of time. Announcement. Kiss has announced its final world tour as of last night. During a performance of Detroit Rock City on America's Got Talent, Kiss announcing they're hanging up their boots and going on a final world tour. After they do the world tour, this is it. They said, Let's see. The End of the Road World Tour is what it's called on their website. No dates or locations have been selected yet, according to the website. But more details of the End of the Road Tour expected to be released very, very soon. But that's it. Although, do you believe them? Is it going to be one of these farewell tours that then comes back with, no, this time we're real serious? But farewell tour for Kiss. Last chance to see them if you want to plan on that. As soon as the dates are posted, I'll post them up on my Twitter feed. All right. Paul Feinbaum on the way next. I'll see y'all tomorrow morning for Mobile Mornings right here on FM Talk 106.5.